It is Thursday, January 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. bombers target Islamic State training camps in Libya. We look at Chinese President Xi Jinping's defense of globalization as a new administration prepares to move into the White House.
It is Xi Jinping not doing anything particularly new, but being very opportunistic, playing the limelight and position himself and China for a greater leadership role in world affairs.
And a Chinese-American artist broke barriers to create the Disney film Bambi. It's all ahead. Pentagon officials say U.S. B-2 bombers and military drones carried out airstrikes on Islamic State Group military camps late Wednesday, about 45 kilometers southwest of the city of Sirte in Libya. I'm joined now by VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, is it known the extent of the strikes?
Well, yes. We actually got a surprise visit from Secretary of Defense Ash Carter minutes ago. He said that this strike killed more than 80 Islamic State fighters that had been congregating in these two camps.
Why did President Barack Obama authorize these strikes to happen now?
Well, President Obama had formally ended this support operation in Libya in December, but there had been some of these Islamic State fighters that had escaped the Sirte area. And as they were congregating, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter told us that some of these operators were planning external attacks on Europe. And he said that they had plans and they needed to act immediately, and they did.
Was the Libyan government consulted regarding this operation?
Yes, officials that I've spoken to and Secretary Carter said that the attack was made in conjunction with Libya's UN-backed Government of National Accord, and that this was merely an extension of the U.S. operation last year to help the Libyan forces who freed Sirte from IS control earlier last year.
How has the instability in Libya, how has this helped in a way or boosted the activity of Islamic State?
Well, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter actually addressed that as well minutes ago. He said that the Libyan government is very anti-foreigners, very anti-Islamic State, and that had a civil war not broken out, the Libyans themselves would have been able to take care of this force. As you can remember, before U.S. forces got involved in Libya back in August, the Libyan government and the pro-Libyan militias had reduced Islamic State to about 1,000 fighters in the city area of Sirte. After a month of U.S. airstrikes, those 1,000 fighters had been reduced to a couple hundred, and then those couple hundred kind of hunkered in into about three neighborhoods in Sirte near the waterway and had fought for months. Some of them managed to escape and were caught in these camps that were targeted.
All right. Well, my thanks to Carla Babb at the Pentagon. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, you would think that there would be a lot of conversation on social media about all the nomination hearings. Steve Mnuchin, the nominee for the Treasury Secretary, Rick Perry. I mean, there's just so much going on Capitol Hill. There is some talk, but really, I think social media, just like maybe perhaps the country, is really being dominated by tomorrow's event, the inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th president. So there are a bunch of hashtags and people talking back and forth. I'll be honest with you, it really is kind of people talking over each other.
Yeah.
Trump supporters kind of gloating in the wind. And I mean, we've seen this before. I mean, I'm sure Democratic supporters gloated after Obama's first victory. Lots of sort of ill will about the other candidates, both sides. It's really actually rather unappealing. So I'm going to keep, I'll share just a few things that I think are perhaps a little bit more interesting. So first tag, hashtag inaugural. That's a big one. And hashtag inauguration. Two bits of news here. I did not know this. First, again, under hashtag inauguration, hashtag inaugural, Caitlyn Jenner will reportedly be attending the inauguration.
That's interesting.
There you go. So that's a bit of news. And we have some entertainment news. Tony Orlando, this is just breaking, apparently is going to be one of the performers at the Trump inaugural. Tony Orlando, who Well, maybe some of our listeners don't remember.
Tony Orlando and Dawn.
And Dawn.
I remember.
Yes, I remember too, because I'm of a certain age. But anyway, he's going to be there. He says it's a real honor to be there. And again, a lot of people using that hashtag inaugural or hashtag inauguration to not only, you know, say, congratulations, Mr. Trump, but really a lot of just sort of ill will about the outgoing Obama administration. It's not very pleasant at all. Now, on the other side, there is another hashtag, hashtag resist. And here again, you're seeing, you know, some kind of ugly thoughts. These are people who are using this hashtag to say they don't recognize Donald Trump as their president, or they're going to resist him in every way possible and whatnot. So perhaps unexpectedly, there's a certain amount of vitriol there. I guess this is just the way of social media. Here's somebody, L.A. Kaufman, posting pictures from last night here in Washington. 500 fired up, dancing outside at Mike Pence, VP's house. Mr. Pence, come dance. This was a protest staged by LGBT groups. Here's Natalia. A peaceful transfer of power only good when we know our next president isn't working with or for Russia. So again, it's, you know, one always really sort of traditionally in the United States, at the time of an inaugural of a new president, the country really does come together and people give that new incoming president, you know, a certain grace period, a certain honeymoon. Everybody wants the president to succeed. Everybody wants to better the country. We're really not seeing that so much this year. The polls indicate that. Jim Malone and I, we were talking about this yesterday during the President Obama's last news conference, and social media really reflecting it. That people do not seem to be in a mood to come together. They seem to be in a mood to fight.
Yeah, and also, we probably should note that on Saturday there will be that large,
yes,
we assumed large women's protest march.
Exactly. The big protest on Saturday, and we'll wait to see how many other protests may pop up on Friday, Saturday, or on Sunday.
All right. Thanks a lot, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. President-elect Donald Trump heads to Washington a day ahead of his inauguration. President-elect Trump's Treasury nominee faces foreclosure questions. Human Rights Watch says the ruling party in Burundi is responsible for violence across that country. And President-elect Trump's energy secretary nominee regrets proposing closure of the agency. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory may have uncovered new evidence of water on ancient Mars. In recent weeks, the Curiosity rover has been studying rock slabs covered with features scientists say developed as cracks in a drying layer of mud. Lead investigator Nathan Stein, a graduate student at the California Institute of Technology, says that crisscrossed patterns of ridges on the rock slabs look like what you'd see beside the road where muddy ground has dried and cracked. The rocks were found at a site called the Old Soaker, which is located on Lower Mount Sharp, a Martian mountain the Curiosity rover has been slowly climbing since 2014. Previous geological findings made by Curiosity also have suggested that water once existed in ancient Martian lakes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a Chinese-American animator broke barriers to make the Disney classic Bambi. Chinese President Xi Jinping at the UN in Geneva Wednesday held out the promise of multilateral cooperation on matters such as nuclear disarmament, terrorism, and climate change, a day after a speech in defense of globalization at the World Economic Forum in Davos.
"当前世界各国相互依存,
Just 2 days before President-elect Donald Trump is inaugurated, Mr. Xi said, in an age of interdependence, it is our responsibility to build up a community of a shared future for mankind. He said China would continue to work with the international community towards a better future for mankind. RAND Corporation analyst Andrew Scobell tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, while such language is nothing new, it may reflect a subtle challenge to the global leadership of the U.S. as Mr. Trump takes office.
Given the transition that's taking place in U.S. politics from one administration to another, he seems to be trying to take advantage of a void or a gap. In that sense, he's trying to claim the mantle of leadership in the world at Geneva. It is Xi Jinping not doing anything particularly new, but being very opportunistic, claim the limelight and position himself and China for a greater leadership role in world affairs.
Mr. Xi also met on the sidelines in Geneva with the new UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, who said that he was very reassured to see that China is assuming a clear leadership in multilateralism in today's world. Obviously, China views itself differently than it did even just 10 years ago.
China's been rethinking multilateralism for a number of years. So this is a gradual shift in Chinese thinking, style of its diplomacy, more greater comfort in multilateral settings such as the UN. It is a discernible trend, and with the question marks that surround what exactly the policies of the Trump administration will be, this is a clear play by the Chinese to stake out a stronger, more prominent leadership position.
That's Andrew Scobell of the RAND Corporation. While he suspects the fiery rhetoric of Mr. Trump will moderate over time, he said China remains uncertain of the trajectory of future U.S.-China relations. Ankit Panda, co-editor of the Asia-Pacific current events publication The Diplomat, said China's policies don't often match his globalization rhetoric.
There's a long laundry list of tariff and non-tariff barriers that China has undertaken on trade. So when Xi Jinping goes to Davos and he tells the world that free trade is good, globalization is good, China will stand up for this, I think we should take this with a grain of salt. You know, you can point to China's cultivation of new multilateral banking institutions, including the BRICS New Development Bank and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. You can look at a very recent Chinese white paper on Asia-Pacific security. You know, you'll note that many of these institutions and statements that China has made are more focused on the Asia-Pacific region more broadly. So I'd say when it comes to multilateralism, interest in global governance, yes, China is interested in preserving the Paris Accord, and yes, China is interested in playing a greater role in UN peacekeeping operations, for example. But more specifically, I'd say that its rulemaking aspirations are, for the moment, still limited to the Asia-Pacific region.
Ankit, I want to pick up on a theme that seems to have played in Mr. Xi's remarks. Quote, nuclear weapons should be completely prohibited and destroyed over time. Is this a new policy?
I believe it's not a new policy on the part of China. China has broadly supported the non-proliferation regime and supported disarmament. Obviously, here again, China's record is a little bit more checkered. There's evidence that China, for example, assisted Pakistan's nuclear breakout and may have conducted nuclear tests on behalf of Pakistan before ceding to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But again, the fact that she would bring something like up at Davos again shows that China is interested in at least sounding like a responsible global power.
That's Ankit Panda. He's the co-editor of the Asia-Pacific current events publication, The Diplomat. On Wednesday, the American Chamber of Commerce in China released its annual survey showing more than 80% of its 500 members felt less welcome and hold out little hope in China's promises to open its markets. It also found that 1 in 4 is shifting operations to other countries because of unclear laws, inconsistent regulation, and difficulty in obtaining licenses. This is VOA.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans.
On Friday, January 20th, all eyes will be on Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of Donald J. Trump as the 45th U.S. president. Be a part of history. Join VOA for 2 hours of special live coverage on radio and television and on the internet at voanews.com. So tune in Friday, January 20th, starting at 1600 UTC, right here on VOA.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Pioneering Chinese-American artist Tyrus Wong died in the final days of 2016. He was 106 years old. He's best known for his work on the animated Disney classic Bambi, although recognition for that contribution was a long time in coming. He overcame poverty and discrimination to become a renowned painter and Hollywood studio artist. Reporter Heidi Chang looks back at his amazing legacy, which continues to inspire artists and filmmakers today.
What you gonna call him?
Well, I think I'll call him Bambi.
Bambi. Yep, I guess I'm doing all right.
The movie Bambi has captivated audiences around the world for decades, and Tyrus Wong's contribution is one of the reasons why. The Chinese-American artist, inspired by landscape painting of the Song Dynasty, created the look of the film. But that accomplishment would have been hard to imagine in 1919, when Wong arrived in the United States as a young boy with his father from a poor village in China. Anti-Chinese laws at that time made it extremely difficult for Chinese to enter the country, but the Wongs eventually settled in Los Angeles. His father encouraged him to practice calligraphy. Since they couldn't afford ink or drawing paper, he'd dip his brush in water and draw characters on old newspapers.
I used to draw every day. My father made me draw, you know, every night before I do that. And they come over and holding a brush like that, you know, you almost fall asleep, you know, they're holding it like that.
Eventually, Wong attended art school, where he studied art during the day and worked there as a janitor at night.
I love to paint. Anything else, I'm no good at all.
But making a living as a fine artist wasn't easy. So Wong got a job at the Walt Disney Studio in 1938, drawing the frames in between the animators' key drawings. When he heard Disney was making a film based on the novel Bambi, he drew sketches of deer in a forest and showed them to his supervisor. Those images caught Walt Disney's eye, and Wong's artwork ended up inspiring the visual look of the film. But Wong was fired before Bambi was completed in 1942 after a labor strike, and his contributions to the film were never fully recognized. Instead, he was credited as one of the background artists. Wong went on to work at other studios and also created fine art, top-selling Christmas cards, and paintings to decorate dinnerware. Filmmaker Pamela Tom captures his life story in a new documentary called Tyrus and hopes it will inspire others who want to pursue their dreams.
I think people just have to realize and remember how unusual it really was at that time for an Asian to be working in Hollywood and what he was up against, you know, the prejudice and the discrimination. For him to overcome that and endure and to have a sustained career for over 30 years in the film industry at that time is just remarkable.
Tyrus Wong's contributions to American art and culture were belatedly recognized in 2001, when he was named a Disney legend. And in 2013, the Walt Disney Family Museum mounted a retrospective of his art.
When you look at these paintings, you can almost feel the morning dew on the forest, or you can almost smell the fresh air and the moss and the feel of the forest. And that's the beauty of what Tyrus's work. He tells a story, and you get an emotion from the art.
Exhibition curator Michael Labrie says Tyrus's innovative work transformed the art of animation.
You know, because they had been struggling with Bambi after doing Snow White, and everything was very detailed, and the animals were getting lost in the forest. So the idea that he was able to create the depth and feel of these massive forests and meadows with a few lines, I think that that was revolutionary in the animation field. Not only did you fall in love with the animals, you fell in love with the forest.
And many artists fell in love with his work, including Oscar-winning filmmaker Ralph Eggleston, a production designer at Pixar Animation Studios.
He's the very definition of someone who really understood the term inspirational art. It was artwork that was meant to inspire an entire crew of people. Animation is filmmaking is a very collaborative effort. His impact to the artists at the time the film was made was also as strong as what it's become in the minds of all of us since.
After retiring in 1968, Tyrus Wong continued to share his art with the world by creating whimsical kites, flying butterflies, flocks of birds, and 30-meter-long centipedes. As they soared over Santa Monica Beach, it seemed as if he was still painting, but this time his canvas was the sky. For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the last 6 years, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his regime are responsible for the deaths of thousands of Syrians. Perhaps one of the most horrific means of slaughter employed by the regime has been its repeated use of chemical weapons. In a recent blog post, Acting Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, Thomas Countryman, called for the Syrian regime to be held to account. The United Nations Security Council, he said, needs to vote soon on a resolution to hold accountable individuals involved in the Syrian chemical weapons program. Following the brutal sarin gas attack on August 21, 2013, the United States worked with the international community to broker the framework for the elimination of the Syrian chemical weapons program. Under this framework, Syria committed to join the Chemical Weapons Convention and to fully eliminate its chemical weapons program. All told, the international community removed and destroyed over 1,200 metric tons of Syria's declared chemical weapons stockpile. An independent international panel established by the UN Security Council in 2015 concluded at the end of 2016 that Syrian Arab armed forces used chlorine barrel bombs on civilians in 3 separate attacks in Syria in 2014 and 2015. The panel also determined that the Islamic State used mustard gas in Moria in August 2015. As President Obama said, there are those who are trying to obfuscate the truth about what is happening in Syria. But the evidence that the Assad regime and Islamic State use chemical weapons is overwhelming. No person, group, or nation, said Undersecretary Countryman, should ever be allowed to use chemical weapons with impunity. Now it is time for the UN Security Council to act. The United States will defend the principles, laws, and norms laid out in the Chemical Weapons Convention. The Treasury Department recently announced sanctions designations for 18 senior Syrian regime officials in response to the international panel's findings. Announcing the sanctions, the White House condemned in the strongest possible terms the Syrian regime's use of chemical weapons. We have also been making concrete progress towards the goal of degrading and ultimately destroying the Islamic State and its chemical weapons capability in partnership with the Global Counter-ISIL Coalition. The U.S. is prepared to take further action to pursue accountability and promote the norm against chemical weapons. And we call on other members of the international community to do the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.